Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you, your well-being, your community, and what I call your total health environment, the health of your food, water, air, and earth, the health and caring factors in our society, the health of the various vectors that bring us all we need in our interconnected world, and finally, the health of our greater ecological system. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between you and all of these different aspects and sectors of this complex world through talking with different thought leaders, activists, authors, scientists, policymakers, decision makers, political figures, filmmakers, everybody on earth, because our world is quite specialized. But all of this is interconnected and affects us, and so we talk to people in all these different spheres to get a grasp of what's going on, to get involved, and to be activated in supporting what's going to protect us and our health and well-being of the planet. On today's show, I'm really honored and thrilled to welcome Alex Lawson, who's the Executive Director of Social Security Works. And just to clue you in what that's all about, in case you hadn't heard of that organization, they are there, and in fact, they're right down in Washington today as we speak, defending our rights and the offerings of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and prescription drugs. There's a big battle going on, which we'll hear more about from Alex on the show, within the larger context of the fight to get Medicare for all deepened, strengthened, and available to all Americans, which time has come. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Alex Lawson. So thrilled to have you here with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
This is really, something crucial, and every time I read about what you guys are up to and what's on offer, it's more important. You know, I just want to kind of bracket our conversation by saying that I, for a long time, have been a health reporter, and before I began actively reporting on food and the environment and health, I really have been coming from the proactive stance, which is what can we do to promote and protect our health in terms of holistic offerings, better nutrition, more availability of food to all sectors of society, as well as a healthy environment that's neither endangered on a planetary level due to climate change, nor environmentally toxic due to the gas, chemical, nuclear, and other industries, that actually have downsides and externalities that impact our health. So many of my long-term followers, because I've been about this for about 25 years, are a little surprised to see me concerned and engaged in the Medicare for All fight. And the reason for that is simply that we have to cover both sides of the spectrum. And when we get Medicare for All, I'm going to be there standing in line saying, and now let's put in healthy food for everybody and all the integrative modalities that can help support people's health so that we don't have to wind up needing drugs and surgery and all kinds of advanced care because there are contaminants in our neighborhood and in our food and in our system. Nevertheless, I stand strong because, people need it. I mean, that's just the bottom line. People need Medicare for All. They need drugs. They need all of these healthcare practices because, we age, we're exposed to different things, and significant segments of the population cannot afford what has become the outlandish prices of American healthcare. So I just want to, mention that to my longtime listeners who, are surprised to hear me perhaps championing this, but this is the reason. And also, the healthcare services that have existed, come into being through science, need to be available to everyone. We can't have people not taking needed medications because they can't afford them. We can't have people going bankrupt and losing their homes and putting their families out of a home because of unbridled rising healthcare costs. So just to say, that's like where I'm standing, so longtime listeners can understand that this is one of the things that's also interconnected and that we need. So I just want to thank you, Alex, for, you know, your part in this whole fight. And what is it that, you know, I mean, for people who may be younger members of the audience who don't understand the interconnection between Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid and drug pricing, can you kind of let us know, let our listeners know why all those dots are connected and need to be?
Definitely. That's a great, just a really great setup. And I actually want to go one further on this show, Connect the Dots. I want to actually try to connect the dots a little bit more with you on why creating a healthy environment is actually the same as fighting for Medicare for All. So if you would, I'm going to attempt to do a little bit of that. And
please,
it all starts with the greedy liars on Wall Street. And what you got to understand about these greedy liars on Wall Street is that they make money off of broken things, broken systems, broken neighborhoods, broken families, broken people, misery, destruction. All of that poverty is extremely profitable to these people who have no moral compass. And they just look at humanity the way a parasite looks at a host to stick to and extract wealth from so that they can try to fill the hole in themselves with another golden yacht. And this isn't just rhetoric. I want to say that the word that people should understand to see this, to trace this through all of it, is financialization. What Wall Street has done is financialized every aspect of our lives and our health. So what that means is you scratch something and behind it, you find private equity and hedge funds, right? You see the collapse of neighborhood stores, which includes, you know, restaurants on Main Street that might have had sourced things more locally. Well, that's not available anymore. Now you're looking at franchises and fast food, and you're looking at all of these offerings that are not healthy. And you go behind them and you find hedge funds and private equity because this is a financialized system. It starts with neighborhoods where you can find a payday lender much more easily than you can find healthy food offerings. And that's not an accident. You can find, you know, a corner store with cigarettes and alcohol, maybe a gun store, more easily than you can find food products that are actually nutritious. It's easier to find, again, you know, I don't want to zoom to the end, but the end of this is a dialysis center, which is basically run by two hedge funds. So first you have lack of healthy food, lack of neighborhoods that work, lack of available financing and credit through community banks or public banks, so that you have people on this hamster wheel where they're just surviving, and they're barely surviving. And if they trip up, even if it's absolutely not their fault at all, a person's doing everything they can, and they just happen to get sick, that's when the financialized health system really gets its claws into them, because then they're going to go, you know, and they're going to call an ambulance. It's going to take them to the hospital. They're going to, even if they're quote unquote doing everything right, they've got a job, they're working, they're covered by insurance at their job, they get sick, They go to the hospital. They actually find out that they're too sick to work. They lose mm-hmm. their job. They lose their insurance. And then the next thing that happens is they get that enormous $50,000 bill from the ambulance, and then the $90,000 bill from the hospital. They learn actually that the doctor in the hospital was quote unquote out of network. So they get a $300,000 bill from that person. And now they're going to go bankrupt. And they you know, medical bankruptcies are still the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country, which is immoral. It's absolutely stunning that we allow this to happen, that you can go bankrupt from getting sick. You can go bankrupt from getting hurt. And the reason is all of these things are connected through the financialization of our lives, where Wall Street has these front groups, big insurance, big pharma, and their entire thing is to extract as much wealth from us as possible. And it also explains why they hate things that work, why they hate Social Security, for example. Social Security is wage insurance against the loss of wages due to old age, a disability, or for the surviving children in the death of a breadwinner. And it does all this. It's a $1.5 million policy of life and disability insurance and an inflation-protected annuity when a person retires. Does all that for an administrative cost of less than 1%. So 99 cents of every dollar that we pay into this system in premiums comes back to us in the form of benefits. And Wall Street sees that, and they see it as a missed opportunity, because they would add 25, 30% administrative costs so they could get another golden yacht, and they'd sell a worser product. So they try to destroy Social Security because it works. They try to destroy Medicare because it works. They try to create chaos because that's how they profit. So when we're fighting to create these systems that are answerable to the people, systems that work, Social Security and expanding Social Security, Medicare, improving Medicare and expanding it to everyone so that profit is removed from our healthcare system, we are literally fighting the same opponents as those who are creating a infrastructure that keeps us unhealthy and sick. So I'm hoping that that was followable. But what you let in, it's absolutely the same fight, because our enemies, our opponents are the same. And the only way we're going to beat them, the only way the people are going to beat Wall Street and their front groups and big insurance and big pharma and big agriculture is with solidarity. It is by standing together and raising our voices together. Which is why I'm so happy I'm get this chance to speak with you and your listeners.
Thank you so much, Alex. And, you know, that's 100% true. Recently on the show, you know, I kind of episodically, because of what the show promises, cover a lot of different arenas, and we go through different areas. I mean, there were years when we were covering fossil fuels because I was the first reporter on fracking. There were years when we were covering the trade deals because they were going to put fossil fuels, excavation, pipelines, transport and production, exported all across the world. And what was that going to do to our environment? I was a lead reporter on that when the New York Times wasn't covering it. I was reporting fracking when they weren't covering fracking. Most recently we've been doing a lot on food, agriculture, regenerative agriculture, and the Green New Deal. We've had just like a whole series of shows on that. These things are all connected. And I'll share with you that in around 2010, 2011 or so, I began working on a book, and I detailed the interconnection between all of these industries and the adverse impacts on our health and environmental well-being, you know, which is basically our survival. I talked about these very issues, the food supply, gas and oil, fossil fuels, energy, and healthcare. All of that was in the book, and I have written best-selling books on health, self-help, for major publishers for quite a few years with prominent doctors. When we went out to sell that book with the agent, you know, people were like, well, what's the solution? And, well, the solution is a change in social policy. The solution is a lot of people wake up and begin to realize what's happening. And they said back in, I guess when we were finally outselling it in 2012 or 2013, they said, well, oh, no, the publishing industry said that can never happen. Nobody wants to know about this. Nobody wants to deal with this. Nobody wants to read a book that details how all these things are connected. And I said, and they said, you need solutions. I said, the solutions are going to be a whole other book. They're going to be another chapter of history where we go out, we get activated, we tackle these problems. So I kind of feel like, you know, so gratified and so grateful that this has become the work of our time. It's better than putting out a book to tell people about it, to have, like, the whole next generation and generations of people awoke to this, fighting for it, working together, supporting each other, and, you know, instead of sitting back and going, oh, well, we have to compromise, and this can't change, and that can't change, and they won't let us, and, you know, and all of that, instead people are going, no, and from so many different angles. So I feel like, you know, my book went into, my own published book went into the ether and became generative. And it's kind of a, you know, a handbook in the sky for, like, everything that needs to be corrected during this time. And, yeah, I mean, this is exactly what's going on. And the thing is that, you know, we know what's going on with the millionaires. And so, you know, there and what you've just described is the immoral way that all of these externalities and profit-driven choices that ignore people are actually playing out with human beings in human communities as the people who are kind of, you know, kind of more okay kind of look the other way. And so that looking the other way because, you know, it's so painful or horrible or what can I do about it is, you know, I would say a borderline amoral stance, you know. And so we're always out to inform everybody so that you can enlist and tell people where to go and what to do and what organization to get involved with supporting so that we really can be engaged and win this fight. And everybody, every single American is accountable because this is our society, this is our economy. And, you know, we had maybe very poor excuses for not knowing our history and not knowing how we got here and not knowing what to do now as, like, you know, the publishers didn't know, like, you know, 6 years ago because a lot of this built-out activism, you know, was in process and not quite crystallized as it is now. But now there's no more excuse. Just want to mention, again, we're talking with Alex Lawson, the Executive Director of Social Security Works, and invite people to support the organization, to volunteer and do advocacy with the organization, and you can find them online at socialsecurityworks.org. You know, it would be, what would be different in our world if we really took the step of taking care of people in the way that you're fighting for? Like, you know, what would that be like? I mean, I'm just thinking of this because recently Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez worked with some people from The Intercept and put out, you know, a kind of visionary short film that showed us winning the Green New Deal, right? Because, you know, instead of showing Nancy Pelosi, you know, going, oh, it's the Green New Dream, or showing Dianne Feinstein going, oh, leave it to me, I'm going to handle it, what are you talking about, you know, to a group of concerned kids, you know, the Sunrise Movement, who've been so activated lately. You know, what would our world look like if we began to say, yes, we need this for ourselves, it can be done, we deserve it. You know, how do we, what would it look like? And then let's talk about how we get there after we've talked about what it would look like. What's your vision of that, Alex?
So I think, you know, a fundamental difference between, you know, people like me, people like you and your listeners, and is that we believe in the future. And I know that sounds sort of weird, but I think what you have to understand about the greedy liars on Wall Street is that they're nihilists. They believe in nothing but greed and power, and it's a unfillable hole of avarice that they have. So they're not looking into the future. And what we're saying is we know that our time is short, is limited individually, but together, collectively, as a society, as a international world, as humanity, we actually have a long future if we can work together. And I think one of the key changes in our time, and I think we are on the precipice of it, but possibly it's a forked path, is that we have been in an extractive mentality, in an extractive economy for so long. You know, there's billions of humans on this earth, and to support humanity, we've been ripping resources out of the earth, and we see everything is pulling resources out. You know, that's that financialization. They see people as resources to pull money from, load people up with debt, with student debt. You know, oh, you got to go to college to get a good job. Oh, but to go to college, you got to get all of this student debt, and your good job is mainly going to go to pay down that student debt, right? And at the end of the day, you have this oligarchic, this aristocratic elite who are actually taking all of the resources. So the future is to change from that extractive sort of economy to something that is maybe looks more like a protective economy that sees the value of the resources that we do have and the enormous value that we can get from protecting those resources. So instead of actually looking at, you know, a dwindling rainforest in Brazil and seeing it as we got to log it and clear cut it and plant sugar cane so that we can grow sugar, so that we have to have the government subsidize the farmers by buying the sugar because we don't actually need all that sugar in America. Our that's a Brazilian thing, is a subsidized sugar economy. In America, it's corn, where we actually pay farmers to make more corn than we actually need. And then we're like, all right, we'll grind it up, turn it into ethanol, and burn it in cars because we don't have anything else to do with this corn. We would shift our mentality, and we would look at resources and say, we need to protect this rainforest. We need to actually protect these resources that we do have. And when we do that, we can find that there's so much more value in the resources as we protect them. When we see our people as resources that we ourselves, we the people, protect and raise up together, it means we would invest in our kids. We wouldn't say, you need to actually leverage yourself to the hilt. You need to carry tens of thousands of dollars of debt to get that education. We'll say, you know what? Not only is education going to be free, we'll pay you to get a higher education. We'll subsidize your educational quest to learn more, because then you will be a more productive member of our collective society here, and we will be able to do more things together. When we look at, you know, a crisis in, you know, this extractive economy around oil and plastics and climate change and all of that, in a protective sort of vision, we would say, let's solve this together. Let's actually see this problem as an opportunity, because I believe in a future for my children, and that future for my children has to have an earth that's inhabitable. So let's figure out how we can remove carbon from the ecosystem, from the atmosphere. Let's build concrete out of it. Let's look at how we can move away from plastics and also deal with the plastics that are, you know, choking our waterways, et cetera. And you zoom one back from that, and the only way we're going to be able to dream big and do that and accomplish it is when people have the freedom from the fear that they're going to go bankrupt from getting sick. People need a freedom, an economic freedom, that they can take risks, that they don't have to be on this hamster wheel with a job that barely pays the bills and is making them sick. But they need that job because it provides them their health insurance and their family their health insurance, right? We would build a system that would unleash the potential of our society, and we would see people not as something to extract wealth from. We would see people as building power and resources together. And in that future, the only losers in that future are that oligarchic class, that parasitic aristocrats, the idle rich who do nothing but profit off of their existing capital. They're going to lose in the new future. They're not going to win. And we're not going to have there's no possibility of the future that we're painting here when you have three individuals who hold as much wealth as the bottom 40% of the American people. That level of inequality is not only immoral, and it is immoral, that level of inequality is unsustainable. And we actually have to direct policies that lessen the inequality. So the rich have created an upward redistribution of wealth. They reach their hands into our pockets, and they steal our money. They do that from every angle. What we have to do is create a redistributive economy that takes resources from this oligarchic class and redistributes them to working people. We can do that by, say, expanding Social Security massively and creating a progressive revenue stream for it, creating an improved Medicare for All system. Again, that what that would do is create this big base. The working families would no longer be, you know, to enrich the insurers and pharmaceutical industry. So that's kind of the vision that we have to see. It's building a country that works for the people, for the many, and not for the few.
Yeah, you know, I live in New York, New York. I'm a native New Yorker, but I also reside and have resided in many different kinds of communities. And, you know, one of the things that I very often hear, you know, from some of our more red state kind of people, or, you know, Republican allied or Trump supporting people, is why should I pay for somebody else's bills, right? You know, in terms of someone else's health insurance coverage, you know, why should we have the government paying for that? And, you know, it's really interesting because I do feel that this comes from, you know, it's like some people experiencing economic hardship will be able to say, I want this for myself, and I want it for everyone. Other people, you know, get stuck with, I have to fight to keep where I am, and no one else, you know, I can't afford to give anything to everyone, and don't steal from my pocket, you know, kind of thing. And that's how they will look at exactly the same program, you know, from that angle. The people are different from me. Maybe I can't really, I haven't known people who are different. I can't identify them as human beings. I'm too hard-strapped myself to get wherever I got today, no matter, you know, where that might be. And, you know, like, I'm not responsible for you. And the thing is that this is coming from fear. It's coming from a history of or a fear of economic hardship, and I think you're really, really accurate in pointing out the fear. And it's also coming from, it comes from and it produces social breakdown. And, you know, social breakdown doesn't really work for anybody because it means that, you know, because everybody wants to pick the social breakdown that they think is okay. Like, I want the right to do this or the right to do that and, you know, express myself as an individual or have this individual right, but the places where the society cares for the people have been attacked and undermined and degraded over many years, and, you know, we can see it in highway infrastructures, we can see it in bad turns taken in terms of, you know, late-stage fossil fuel extraction, you know, which is dirty for communities and for the planet and for people's health. It's a public health problem. You know, we can see those bad choices arising from the system, you know, that you're describing, Alex, which I think is quite accurate, and I share that view. You know, but we made the, but, you know, but still there, you know, And then it's also taught us to sort of distrust and fear and hoard and, you know, regard the other guy as a threat rather than as another human being who's also struggling, you know. And so so then it's like, you know, he's taking from me or they're taking what I don't have, and then we're all fighting with and divided from one another, which is what we see politically, you know, in rural areas and many communities right now. And it's all the product of economic desperation and fear, which has been induced and thrust upon the population as these people have taken our resources, used our labor, and run off with the goods, you know. So I think we really have to understand it that way. We have to learn to explain it that way. To our neighbors, because this is something, I mean, I was in a discussion with someone about Medicare for All on a thread in one of the many communities that I intersect with, you know, a week or so ago, and this guy could not understand that it would benefit him. It would benefit him, you know. I mean, he was so distracted by it might benefit somebody else. And this is called fear, economic deprivation, and the breakdown of the social contract, which is, you know, is and has been, should be, and will be again, a safety net that supports us all. That's like what it's there for, and that's what it should be doing. And we have to restore that. I mean, what are the economics of some of these things we're talking about so that also the fears that people have that, you know, we're both talking about can be dispelled?
That's a really great setup as well to this discussion. This is just a fun discussion. I want to take it in so many directions, but one thing I will note just in listening, you're spot on. I would add one thing. It's actually in the way that our consumer-based extractive economy is set up is actually fundamentally, the first thing is to make people feel that they're alone. We actually, let me go through this and then we'll get to the economic impact of these community-based programs like Social Security and Medicare for All and also canceling all student debt. But first, I want to go back to Sigmund Freud's nephew. After World War II, he actually created a thing. He figured out something that works on humans. It's called inferiority marketing. And the first thing so what it does is it actually gets people to buy things that they don't need. So we had all this excess capacity after World War II, and we had this wartime economy. Actually, World War II and what we were able to accomplish with our economy when we added, I mean, it was full command control because it was a wartime economy, but imagine if there is just some control on our economy led by the people. You actually can look at what we did then and how fast we did it and how our economy is so large that it actually took those disruptions just completely in stride. For anyone who's saying, oh, the Green New Deal, this or that, you're like, well, look what we've done before. But back to inferiority marketing, we were looking as a nation, like, what are we going to do with all this excess capacity? And basically the answer was a lot of it was going to turn to consumer stuff, and we were going to turn to consumers to buy all this stuff. But what about the fact that once they bought something, they didn't need to buy it again? How do we get them to buy next year's model of the thing that they already have? And the answer was inferiority marketing. So you actually hit people with this thing, like, are you not satisfied where you are at work? Is your work, you know, satisfaction too low? Are you not pretty enough? Are you a little bit too overweight? All of these things. It's first, you hit a person with a problem, and then you insert a magical solution, and the solution is the product. And it doesn't even have to be related to the actual, like, you know, the inferiority thing that you're saying. It doesn't have to be, you know, I can say, like, are you not successful enough at work? Well, does your razor only have two blades on it? Try seven. And this is actually very well studied, and I'd be happy to send people more resources on this. Brandwashed is one of the more recent books on this. Squeeze This, Mr. Whipple is kind of one of the fundamental ones but it's also what all advertising is based on. And the reason this is important is because it's billions and billions of dollars of corporate money go into this aspect, and it creates, you know, aggregate trillions of dollars of economy, because consumers buying things is what powers our economy. The first thing for this whole system to work is actually to make people feel alone, because if they have to solve all of their own problems, then you can use this, okay, buy a razor blade with 7 razors because it'll be so much better than with 6. You need this year's car or this year's washing machine or this brand of sneakers or that brand of whatever. It all starts by breaking down community, and it all puts the entire burden of everything on the individual. And then, you know, we even try to sell that as the, like, no, this is culturally powerful, rugged individualism. But it also puts the burden of all solutions onto the people, like, climate change is really a problem, and it's up to you, individual, to do it. And that can feel overwhelming. It's also untrue. Right. You look at who's causing climate change, and it's a small number of giant institutions, of corporations who are doing it. It's not individuals. Yes, we can make change individually. But in fact, we need big, huge policy changes to address these societal problems. And it's not up to the individual. It's up to the individual to do one thing. The most radical act we can take to stand against all of this is to get organized, to realize that we're not in it alone, that rugged individualism is actually how they sold cigarettes to us with the Marlboro Man, right? Like, it's a con. We've accomplished our greatest things in this country and in all times when humanity has accomplished great things by working together. And so that radical act is to actually find your neighbors and allies, organizations who do, who focus on the things that you care about, and to engage with them, to stand with them, and to feel the power that comes when you recognize that alone my voice is weak, alone my voice is quiet. But when there's millions of us standing together, shoulder to shoulder, our voices cannot be ignored. And that people power will beat money power every single time, which is why money power is so terrified of us learning that secret, that they spend all their time and money trying to isolate us and make us feel alone. And they lie to us, and they hit us with these massive amounts of propaganda. Some of it is just overt propaganda, like Fox, Murdoch's entire operation is just a mind-warping propaganda operation, but also it's hidden in, you know, Madison Avenue's how to get us to buy stuff, and that is sort of self-perpetuating. So when we get radical by getting organized, we can make these big changes. So let's just take one. Elizabeth Warren just kind of surfaced this policy as a possibility, canceling student debt. So $1.6 trillion in student debt. This is a new thing. It's only since the 80s that they've had this concept of, like, oh, you want to get an education? You're going to now have soul-crushing and hope-crushing levels of student debt. You won't be able to buy a car or a house. You're going to be stuck in this perpetual cycle of just making it, because any money that you make is going to go to pay down your student debt. We, the people, the federal government, actually originates over 90% of that student debt. So we can just demand together, when we get organized and we feel our power and we say, cancel that student debt. Elizabeth Warren proposed canceling $50,000 of most people's student debt. It'd be about 75% of people's student debt. I say just cancel everyone's, 100% of student debt. It's a click of a few keys on a computer, and wham, $1.6 trillion is injected into the economy, because instead of paying to Navient or the other student debt companies that actually collect it, people would have that money in their bank accounts and they could do what they wanted. They could take their family out for a nice vacation or whatever they wanted, but they would spend that money into the economy, and that would create more economic power and growth for people, not for the millionaires and billionaires on Wall Street. So that's
absolutely
the kind of
I just
idea.
Want to I just want to interject here. You know, there's so many things that we have innovated, you know, and this is like speaking as a, you know, a mature person and whatever. But, you know, when I went to college, I went to what was regarded and known as the most expensive college in America, right? And that was Sarah Lawrence College, because we received a lot of individual attention. We had a lot of access to these very high quality professors that we had. I studied with some absolutely amazing people, you know, thanks to going there. And what did my parents pay? Because they basically paid for my education, but then I had to work to pay for the other things, which was also great, because work was not a dirty word, and I worked in the healthy bakery on campus and made breads and stuff like that. They paid $7,000.
Right.
What's going on today? I mean, so, you know, all of these things that, you know, are viewed as necessities or how it works, these are all invented. You know, we could invent them in the other direction, and it would be a darn good idea, because, you know, it used to be that getting a college education was the foundation for prosperity. Now it's the foundation for a lifelong debt burden, you know, right from the beginning. You know, we created that. We allow that to be created. We can uncreate it. It's not a given, you know, that this has to go on this way.
Exactly.
Your
it's
thoughts.
About priorities and choices
mm-hmm.
that we make as a society. So we decide
mm-hmm.
right now that we're going to subsidize billionaires. We decide, like, you know, you just say we're representative democracy, and, you know, the Republicans were in power. They represented the people, even though they don't represent the people. But we decided there was a tax scam that the Republicans perpetrated on the American people. But it was $1.6 trillion. It was just a handout to billionaires and corporations who used that to for stock buybacks and dividends, which meant it all went to the same billionaire class. It was just a handout of $1.6 trillion. That's literally the same amount as all the student debt held in America. The choice that we made as a nation was to just give $1.6 trillion to the billionaire class, who took that money, and yeah, maybe they bought another golden yacht. I use that as a rhetorical flourish all the time. But the truth is, they probably didn't, because they're worth so much money that they don't do anything with it. They just send it to an offshore bank somewhere, and they sit on that money. What is Bezos going to do with his over $100 billion when he gets, you know, tens of millions or hundreds of millions in a tax handout? He's not going to do anything with that. He's just going to sit on it. It's not even going to be invested back into the economy. We made a choice to give $1.6 trillion to billionaires instead of giving $1.6 trillion back to the people who did, you know, quote unquote, the right thing in getting an education. Obviously, if we cancel all student debt, we also have to make college free, and we have to do more than that. But that really shows you, because the magnitude is the same, $1.6 trillion, that what we're talking about are choices. Public policy is actually just choices we make for how we have our priorities set. And right now in America, the priorities are that if you're born rich, everything is for you, and you're going to die richer. That's the system that's set up. Your money is going to work harder than any amount of labor could. And that's that financialization. We're going to create all these abilities for money to just be invested behind all of these terrible industries to extract more money out. We set up a system that allows that to happen. We can absolutely decide, you know what? I don't think we should create a society that works for you know, a couple thousand families, these billionaire class. I want a society that works for the majority of people. And what we do then is create programs like an expanded Social Security with a progressive revenue system. Right now, the payroll tax is capped around $130,000 a year. After that, people don't pay in on their Social Security, so it's a regressive tax. The benefit structure is so progressive that it's still one of the most progressive systems out there in terms of redistributive, because lower income folks, lower wage folks get more back in terms of benefits than higher wage folks. But if we made the revenue side progressive as well, if we put dedicated an estate tax or a wealth tax to Social Security and then massively expanded the benefits, we would be making a choice to change from billionaires. You know, if you're born rich, you're going to get richer. We want to create a society where if you are born wherever, you have the opportunity to better yourself no matter where you're born. You don't have to be born rich to get richer. Wherever you are, you can better yourself, and your children will be better off than you. And in fact, so will the environment and the earth, because we're going to create a protective economy around this, because we're going to get people off of the hamster wheel. They're not going to be scared of each other. So they're going to see that by working together, we all benefit. Anyways, that's the there's real economics there as well. The wealthy do not actually put money back into the economy where working people do. So when you create policies that work for working families, it actually benefits the economy at large, and it's self-perpetuating. You know, the Republican lie that tax cuts pay for themselves, they don't. They don't pay for themselves because rich people don't spend money. But if you actually go to the Levy Institute, the macroeconomic effect of canceling student debt, by Stephanie Kelton, great economist. She's detailed, and other economists, but Stephanie Kelton is the lead author. She's detailed that canceling $1.6 trillion in student debt would pay for itself through increased economic activity. So this is really about choosing what direction we want to take this country and, in fact, the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll tell you, I'd love to have Stephanie Kelton on the show, actually. I've had Mark Paul on the show discussing economics. We've had Ellen Brown on the show discussing the economics of the Green New Deal. You know, I'm just looking forward to the opportunity to get a few more economists on, because, you know, we've been taught this kind of very primitive, you know, scary fairy tale about the ways economics has to work rather than working for people and for what we want. You know, we've kind of gotten tied up in a, you know, it's like Stockholm syndrome of the economy is really what we have here. And and the minute you start to talk to some of these progressive economists, like the people we're mentioning, is the moment you realize, my God, this is entirely self-induced, or not induced by us, but induced by, you know, the proponents and, you know, the brainwasher media, you know, supporting the 1%, et cetera, you know, to make us think that this is all impossible, and that, in fact, austerity and astringency and tightening is all that will work and that, you know, awaits us, which is really, I mean, it's both when you realize it's all been an imposed, you know, kind of brainwashing system and that we've absorbed it. And meanwhile, these people are cavorting around the world with all this tremendous wealth. And, you know, it's like it's to me, and, you know, I'm not an economist, but that has been, you know, the true liberation is realizing how self-induced this all is and how insane it all is. And, you know, if there's this putative, this false meme that was put out there, and it recurs all the time and people send it to me, you know, that allegedly, you know, Warren Buffett has said, make the members of Congress, you know, receive, you know, cut their benefits and receive this and that, and that'll solve the whole problem. Like, you know, a punitive model. And it's not the congressional, you know, benefits or retirement that are the problem, although there's an inequity in that they get that and the rest of us don't. But it's like the fact that they are, you know, sponsored by these corporations to make their deals and, you know, sell their goods, and that so is the media. That's really the problem. It's not, you know, that they get a pension. And,
right.
Of course, Warren Buffett never said that. But in the minds of people who don't delve in depth into all the stuff we're discussing, because, you know, they're strapped and running to survive and they have health problems and they don't have the time or, you know, the good health to do it, you know, that is like, you know, the kind of the solution that comes to mind. I'll also tell you that, and this is another thing that I am incensed about, but, you know, the other thing that wealthy people do is not just accrue more mansions, although that's true, they do, you know, unoccupied mansions all over the place. But mm-hmm. the other thing they do is that they will develop a pet project. And very often, this is in our beloved continent of Africa, which I have been blessed to visit and spend time in years past, and, you know, the seat of humanity, which is, you know, now being subject to exploitation for its agriculture, you know, by all kinds of monocrop agriculturists and large companies and, you know, that want to take over the actual land from the people who farmed it, which is, like, totally heinous. But very high net worth people will often go to Africa, adopt a small village, you know, get to feel like the great white father or mother, you know, who's coming in and helping out this village of people. And, of course, the people naturally are quite grateful to have a small industry or, you know, kind of a folk craft developed there, or, you know, to have health care or their water cleaned up or whatever, you know, this person is nobly doing, you know, with their tremendous wealth. But it doesn't change the actual system. You know, it goes in into one little tiny place or, you know, and that's so they want to do something cosmetic, you know, and it makes them feel good. And then, see, I'm a philanthropist. And I think that instead of buying into that form of philanthropy and, like, flattering them about it, we need to look at the bigger picture, which is this is just, you know, a feel-good tactic that, you know, admittedly helps a small group of people, while the larger engines that need to be redirected keep grinding on to their benefit and not ours.
I couldn't agree more. I was just going to add, like, to your setup there, that oftentimes the people who are, you know, doing this sort of small project that helps a few people, they actually profited off of the system that created the problem in the first place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, they make all their money off of a system that creates the misery that they're going to take a piece of their money and say they're ameliorating this misery, but in fact what they should do is take themselves out of the game, but they won't, because the rich won't, the greedy won't. It's the people who are going to have to stand up and do that. The last thing, because I know we're running low on time, is
mm-hmm.
you brought up, you know, buying mansions, but it's even, that's a yes, but they also, and this is financialization, the reason that rents and housing costs are skyrocketing around the country is because they're buying up properties as investment properties to continue making money for the billionaire class. So you have, you know, cities, San Francisco, L.A., where there's record levels of homeless folks right now in these cities. And the only things that are going up are these giant luxury developments where
yes.
a ton of the units are empty, because they're actually just held as investment vehicles for this financialized world that we're living in. And that is the switch that the people have to switch. We have to stand together and say, you know what, we're not actually going to stand for this anymore. We're going to build solutions to the problems that people have. We're not going to build empty luxury units so that a billionaire can get another, you know, zero in his bank account.
Absolutely. You know, so I just want to, you know, ask listeners, please go to socialsecurityworks.org, support the organization. If you're in the D.C. area, You can learn more about what they're up to. If you're in, you can financially support them. If you're in the D.C. area, if you can travel to the D.C. area, you know, they're unfolding a whole series of interrelated initiatives, as we discussed, that are, because this is so popular and so needed and such a no-brainer, and actually what all the other developed countries already do for their people, you know, this is the big bus that everyone is getting on board to start the ball rolling for taking back our country, taking back our economy, taking back our world. So, you know, join it. You know, if you don't currently need, you know, medical care, it's not about that. You don't know over a lifetime what you might need, and it's, and you don't know what other people might need because of, you know, our need to reestablish our health after making, you know, making health an externality and a consequence of this profit, these profit-driven industries. So please do participate in any way that you can and let others know, too. This is just a universal boon, and it also, as Alex Lawson, with whom I've been speaking on today's show, you know, has repeatedly said, it's actually the freedom bus that we're taking to free us to do the rest of the good work in saving the planet with the Green New Deal and with elected officials that are not on the take but are really fighting for the people. So thank you so much, Alex Lawson, for being with me on today's Connect the Dots. It's been a complete joy to talk to you. You know, I hope you'll come back again, and I'd love to meet you in person sometime in some action. I hope that happens soon. And, you know, more power to you and everything you're up to. And you know, it's just a total pleasure to have you with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a total pleasure. And let's make it a reality that we do meet up at an action where we're winning policies that are fighting for the people, for the many and not for the few. Thanks so much.
Thank you again, and thank you, listeners, for being with us for another edition of Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Heads tall, keep marching forward in company with all our relations.